Welcome to Onc Live On Air. I'm your host today, Caroline Seymour. Onc Live On Air is a podcast from Onc Live, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, Onc Live covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with the faculty of a recent Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinar on bladder cancer hosted by Cleveland Clinic. At the meeting, faculty shared updates in the management of metastatic urothelial carcinoma, as well as robotic cystectomy and bladder preservation approaches in muscle-invasive bladder cancer. First, we spoke with the chair of the meeting, Shilpa Gupta, MD, a medical oncologist in the Department of Hematology and Medical Oncology at Cleveland Clinic. Listen on to hear Gupta discuss the research that has been done with immunotherapy and metastatic bladder cancer. How did the KEYNOTE 361 and IMvigor 130 trials set the stage for immunotherapy in bladder cancer?
The KEYNOTE 361 and IMvigor 130 trials were primarily looking at the question whether combining immunotherapy with chemotherapy in first-line metastatic urothelial cancer would be better than chemotherapy alone. Also, there was arms of single agent immunotherapy comparing to standard of care chemotherapy. And the results from the IMvigor 130 trial showed that the combination of chemotherapy and immunotherapy slightly improved the progression-free survival. The OS data is not mature yet. And the results from the KEYNOTE 361 were negative for both PFS and OS. So how it impacts the current landscape is that platinum-based chemotherapy still remains the standard of care first-line therapy and not combination with immunotherapy.
And then we also recently saw the results of the Danube trial. How did that trial contribute to our understanding of immunotherapy in this setting?
So the Danube trial looked at immunotherapy doublet of PD-L1 inhibitor and CTLA-4 inhibitor, as well as just PD-L1 inhibitor, comparing to standard of care platinum-based chemotherapy. And this trial was also negative. Neither the immunotherapy doublet nor single agent immunotherapy fared better than chemotherapy. This reinforces the previously seen data that chemotherapy remains the standard of care. And now we know that immunotherapy is not better, and neither is the combination of immunotherapy and chemotherapy better than chemotherapy.
Now, a little more excitingly, the results of the Javelin Bladder 100 trial did show a benefit with immunotherapy, but in the maintenance setting. So would you say that those results indicate that immunotherapy is best served in the maintenance setting?
Yes, absolutely. So looks like for urothelial cancer, unlike lung cancer, we are seeing that upfront use of immunotherapy with chemotherapy is not better than chemotherapy, but when used sequentially in the maintenance setting, as you know, immunotherapy is already approved for platinum refractory setting, but when used even early on for patients who do not progress after platinum-based chemotherapy, it leads to a tremendous survival improvement as seen in the Javelin Bladder 100 trial. So it is providing information that sequential use probably leads to a better therapeutic index than combined use upfront.
And then prior to these trials, immunotherapy did have indications in urothelial carcinoma. How helpful have biomarkers of response been?
In the platinum refractory setting, there was no requirement to look for PD-L1 expression. Patients with a high PD-L1 expression derived a greater benefit, but the indication was for anybody who progresses on platinum-based chemotherapy. And we are still trying to learn how to best select patients who may or may not benefit from immunotherapy approaches.
Do you think perhaps that the field would have more luck maybe looking at biomarkers of lack of response rather than biomarkers of response?
Yes, that's a very important question and is being explored as to what are the biomarkers of lack of response. As we know, only about 25% of patients actually respond to immunotherapy. The vast majority do not. And especially true for patients who have rapid progression on immunotherapy, we really need to understand what is driving their resistance to immunotherapy. There's some early data from other trials that TGF-beta may be a mediator of resistance, and we're still trying to understand the biomarker aspect.
So then where would you say that leaves other novel agents like enfortumab vedotin, for example?
So right now, the enfortumab vedotin is approved for patients with metastatic urothelial cancer who have previously received platinum-based chemotherapy and immunotherapy. And it showed significantly favorable results, and updates on overall survival were recently presented at the ESMO meeting, and the data looks really good. It is currently approved, but the combination with immunotherapy in the first line cisplatin ineligible space is something we are really looking forward to in the near future once it gets approved. The results were quite encouraging from the EV-103 trial. So the role of enfortumab vedotin is probably going to move up to frontline setting to see if combination with immunotherapy will be better than chemotherapy. And the ongoing phase 3 randomized trial, EV-302, is looking at this question.
That would be quite the accomplishment if it proves to be positive.
Yes, absolutely.
Are there any other emerging agents or approaches to be aware of as we look towards the future?
Yes, there are other antibody drug conjugates like sacituzumab, which is being studied, and the toxicity profile and the mechanism of action is different from enfortumab vedotin, the other antibody drug conjugate. So we foresee that in future, patients will get most of these agents at some point in some sequence, and we're looking forward to the data from the randomized trials.
We were then joined by Omar Mian, MD, PhD, Staff in Translational Hematology and Oncology Research and Staff Physician in the Department of Radiation Oncology at Cleveland Clinic. Listen on to hear Mian discuss the optimization of multimodality therapy for bladder preservation.
Selective bladder preservation using trimodality therapy, that's transurethral resection, maximal debulking, which is a limited surgery, followed by chemotherapy and radiation delivered together for bladder preservation, is a good option for many patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. You know, most oncologists know this, but it's still a treatment that is underutilized, primarily just due to, you know, practice patterns, referral patterns, and not really for any evidence that suggests that many patients who are eligible shouldn't get it. And so it's an option that allows sparing of the native bladder, it's curative intent treatment, equivalent survival in well-selected patients when compared to radical cystectomy and neoadjuvant chemotherapy. It's better when you deliver it with chemotherapy. So radiation alone is not a sufficient substitute for chemoradiation and maximal transurethral resection. I also talked about technological advancements that have improved our ability to target the bladder with radiotherapy, focused radiotherapy. And the real influence that has had, the real effect that has had, is to reduce normal tissue toxicity, primarily bowel toxicity. And there's quite a few series comparing intensity modulated radiotherapy and volumetric arc radiotherapy, which is just radiation oncology parlance for shaped radiation fields that target the bladder. There's quite a bit of data now emerging that this allows improved dosimetry with respect to bowel doses, and grade 2, grade 3 toxicity acutely and late GI toxicity or lower. And so taking a treatment that maximizes quality of life and making it even better by reducing acute toxicity. We talked a bit about multidisciplinary involvement, the multidisciplinary patient selection process. You know, patients will see urologists who need to identify patients who are eligible, select those patients, refer them to medical oncology, radiation oncology. Those patients need coordinated care during treatment, the timing of TURBT followed by chemotherapy and radiation, timing of chemotherapy dosing during radiation. And then they need follow-up care. So these patients retain their bladder. You know, bladder is now cancer-free, it's functioning well, and the patient's doing great, but that bladder is still there. Patients who've had a prior malignancy, generally this is true for almost all malignancies, prior malignancy increases your risk of another malignancy. But it's particularly true in diseases like bladder cancer, where there's a field cancerization effect. You know, oftentimes people have exposures, environmental, tobacco, things like that, that put them at risk. So that bladder is at risk of having a second tumor. That bladder is also at risk of having the primary tumor come back. And so close surveillance with regular cystoscopy and imaging, which is the rule in muscle-invasive bladder cancer, which is an aggressive disease with a tendency to metastasize. And so those patients need follow-up, multidisciplinary follow-up care as well. But I would say this is worth it in the trade of saving the native bladder and still curing their cancer. Kind of future directions, where is the research taking us? What are the emerging therapies? And the big one is really the excitement around the combination of radiotherapy and immunotherapy in bladder cancer, and in particular, upfront. So in the neoadjuvant setting, as well as concurrently with chemo radiation for bladder preservation. And there's a number of cooperative group studies and institutional studies looking at that question now. You know, does that combination lead to any additive or perhaps super additive synergistic effects where the radiation and chemotherapy may drive increased immune recognition or clearance of the tumor? And that's an area of very active investigation. We also talked about studies looking at biomarkers for better patient selection based on molecular features of their tumor. Some of the work that we've done here at the Cleveland Clinic, as well as in my lab, looking at variants of bladder cancer and how we can use their molecular characteristics to define groups of bladder cancer patients who we can then more rationally assign to treatment paradigms. At least that's the goal.
We closed out the night with Byron Lee, MD, PhD, a surgeon and scientist in the Department of Urology at Glickman Urological and Kidney Institute at Cleveland Clinic, and joint staff in the Department of Cellular and Molecular Medicine at Lerner Research Institute at Cleveland Clinic. Listen on to hear Lee discuss the evolution of surgery in muscle-invasive bladder cancer.
The advances that have been made in cystectomy technique, specifically the approach to radical cystectomy, this is the mainstay of treatment for patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer who can tolerate surgery. Of course, there are a number of patients who can't tolerate surgery, but those who can undergo surgery are the ones who will benefit most from this operation. It's a very morbid operation, as we know from previous experiences from a lot of other institutions. The operation itself is a very long and arduous operation. Involves in a man removing the bladder, the prostate, and the lymph nodes surrounding those organs, and then reconstructing the urinary tract in one of three ways. In a woman, it involves oftentimes removing the uterus along with the bladder, as well as the fallopian tubes and the ovaries, and a thin strip of the anterior vaginal wall, the local lymph nodes, as well as reconstructing the urinary tract. So as you can imagine, it's a long surgery. It's a tough surgery for patients to recover from. There are a lot of potential complications that can be associated with the surgery. And this is especially true in a population that has a lot of other medical comorbidities. A lot of patients have are lifelong smokers who have some kind of coronary artery disease or peripheral vascular disease. They've had a history of hypertension. Many patients have diabetes. And so for them to undergo the surgery is particularly difficult. And so, you know, what we've done over the years is to, after understanding the complication rates, the types of complications, how they affect the patient, what we've done over the years is to try to improve our surgical outcomes for the surgery. You know, up to about 60 to 70% of patients do have some complication from the surgery within 90 days. Now, most of these complications are not serious complications. Most of these complications, for example, are postoperative ileus, where the bowels haven't completely woken up after surgery, and the patients may suffer from some nausea or vomiting. They may require a nasogastric tube temporarily until the bowels kind of wake up, and then they can tolerate liquids and solid food after that. But there are a small percentage of patients, somewhere between 10-20% of patients, who do have a very serious complication from the surgery that can potentially be life-threatening. The 90-day mortality rate for most series is on the order of anywhere between 1-3%, depending on what you look at. So, you know, there's a real chance of death, even though it's small, there's a real chance of death for these patients. Understanding this has been critical to quality improvement. The way we've done it here at Cleveland Clinic is by moving to a more minimally invasive approach. This initially began with laparoscopic approach, and then we moved quickly onto the robotic approach. And we published a study recently in the Journal of Urology in 2020, which describes our approach, but also our reduction in complications that have followed from changing our approach to the surgery, especially with the incorporation of something called an intracorporeal urinary diversion. Essentially, what that means is to do the last part of the surgery, which is the urinary diversion, and involves manipulation of the bowel completely robotically instead of making an incision and doing it in a more traditional fashion.
Would you say that radical cystectomy has been underutilized? And if so, has it been because of the morbidity that you described?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, I do think radical cystectomy is generally underutilized. You know, I think the major centers, the tertiary care centers that tend to do a lot of radical cystectomies, you know, we do it, we have a process to do it. It's a complicated surgery, involves many members of a multidisciplinary team to carry out successfully and also to follow up with the patients after surgery. So, you know, tertiary care centers tend to do a lot of these surgeries and to do it well, but in the community, you know, it tends to be underutilized and the patients oftentimes don't have any treatment for curative intent, even though they do have muscle-invasive bladder cancer.
Your institution did laparoscopic approaches, now you're moving to robotics. What is the differences and advantages between the two?
Both are forms of minimally invasive surgery. Essentially what that means is we do the surgery through small keyhole incisions, and these incisions are typically about half an inch in diameter. Oftentimes we use about four or five of these incisions to do the surgery. And unlike open surgery, the surgeon's hands remain outside the body, and only working instruments fit through these small keyhole incisions to carry out the entire surgery. The main difference between laparoscopy and robotics, the first one is that the instruments used to carry out the surgery and robotic surgery are obviously hooked up to a robot, and the surgeon sits at the console to perform the surgery. The console is several feet away from the patient, so the surgeon is not immediately bedside. And by hooking up the instruments to the robot, they're powered wrists that allow us more degrees of freedom to manipulate the tissue or manipulate a needle, et cetera, so that we can be more precise in our movements. The other advantage of using the robot is the three-dimensional vision that it provides. Laparoscopy also has three-dimensional monitors, but it requires wearing special glasses to do it and a special monitor setup. But robotic surgery, it's all built into the console. So essentially, robotics is a more advanced version of laparoscopic surgery. It flattens the learning curve for many surgeons because we're able to perform very precise movements in a more natural way.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive On Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field and recaps from our State of the Science summits and Institutional Perspectives in Cancer webinars. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and OncLive SOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you like today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts or Spotify so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.